Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 20th of August. Earlier this week, I met my first North Korean defector, and today I meet probably the richest person I've ever talked to. So my job is somewhat like baseball. You always see something that you've never seen before, even though the game has been around for a long time. I've been around for a long time, too, and I'm hearing new things. And perhaps you will, too. Our guest this hour is a very interesting guy, Nick Hanauer. He is a venture capitalist who is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. He is one of those in the one-tenth of one percenters. He founded, co-founded, and funded more than 30 companies, little ones like the nightclub he started when he was in his 20s, to giant ones like Amazon.com, for which he was the first non-family investor. He founded Aquantiv, an internet advertising company that was sold to Microsoft in 2007 for $6.4 billion. He owns a bank. He says he has been rewarded obscenely for his success, but he sees pitchforks in the future. The divide between the haves and the have-nots is getting worse really fast, and he is concerned about that. He's become a political activist. He founded Civic Ventures, a small group of political troublemakers who are devoted to ideas, policies, and actions that catalyze social change. Also actively involved in a broad variety of civic and philanthropic activities, he is the author of a couple books, including The True Patriot, a pamphlet. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Nick during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Nick. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Good. Thanks for being with us. So here's a pretty provocative statement that you have written. Our country, you say, is rapidly becoming less a capitalist society and more a feudal society. What do you mean?
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that the rate at which wealth is concentrating in the hands of the wealthiest people is accelerating. And, in 1980, about 30 years ago, when Ronald Reagan was elected, the top 1% shared approximately 8% of national income, while the bottom 50% of Americans shared about 18%. But if you fast forward to today, the top 1% shares 23 or 24% of national income, and the bottom 50% share just 11%. So there's been this massive shift of income from the 99% to the 1%, and that trend is continuing and accelerating. And at some point in the future, you don't have a sort of a high functioning capitalist democracy anymore. You have sort of an old fashioned feudal feudal dictatorship like they had in France, mm-hmm. where a few people control everything and most people have nothing. And this is just math, right? You can just put these numbers into a spreadsheet and follow the trends out, and the trend is pretty terrible. And, the basic argument I've been making around the country is that some inequality is good and necessary. Provides incentives, and it reflects the reality of human experience. But rising and radical economic inequality is extremely harmful both to societies but also to economies. Because at the end of the day, if folks don't have money, then who's going to buy the stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good question. I know that you've been at the forefront of the minimum wage campaign, increasing the minimum wage. Seattle, your place, and San Francisco, cities with the highest minimum wage in the country. People have been saying, as other cities contemplate this, you can't raise the minimum wage. It's a job killer.
Yeah, and that claim that if wages for workers go up, employment will go down, is simply not true. It's a misunderstanding or a lie. The only thing that is true about the claim that if wages go up, employment will come down, is that if people like me can get listeners, can get your listeners to believe that it's true, it will work out very, very well for me. There is literally no evidence from American history that shows that when the minimum wage went up, employment went down. In fact, in most cases, when wages go up, employment goes up too, because that's how capitalism works. When workers have more money, businesses have more customers and need more workers. And although it's easy to understand how somebody from the perspective of a small business and who only has this sort of micro perspective would see that, well, if I have to pay my workers more, that will be bad for me and I may have to lay them off. But when everybody raises wages, when every business raises wages, every business gets the benefit of the extra demand that will come from workers who have more money, and every taxpayer is relieved from the burden of having to pay for the poverty programs that low-wage workers depend on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this trope that if wages go up, employment will come down is idiotically untrue, and people have to stop believing it. And there's not a better place to prove this point than Seattle, Washington, which has had the highest minimum wage in the country for a very long time. Washington State has had the highest minimum wage in the country for a long time. And we have a very modest unemployment rate and the highest rate of small business job creation in the country. Seattle, I know I'm droning on, but I just want to give you one very, very important, stark example. So in the rest of the country with federal minimum wage, people who earn tips are penalized, and they earn just not $7.25 plus tips, which is the normal wage, but just $2.13 plus tips. But in Washington State, we have no tip penalty. So in Seattle, for instance, tipped workers now earn $11 per hour plus tips. So that difference is 500%.
Ooh.
Right? It's five times the difference. So if the people who say if wages go up, employment will go down were correct, we would have no restaurants in Seattle, Washington. None.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, and yet, the city with the second highest concentration of restaurants per capita in the country is Seattle. Why? Because when restaurants pay restaurant workers enough so that even they can afford to eat in restaurants, it's not bad for the restaurant business, it's good for it. And you might ask, well, what's the city with the highest concentration of restaurants? Some low-wage utopia in Alabama or something like that? Actually not. The only city in the country that beats Seattle is San Francisco, that pays their tipped workers even more than we pay ours. So anyway, I mean, this idiotic idea that if we pay workers more, that will somehow be bad for employment is just not true.
We go back to Henry Ford, right? You got to pay your workers enough.
Absolutely.
So they can buy a Model T.
Absolutely. And you know, the thing is that, you know, all civilization depends on solving collective action problems, right? Like, should we put our own fires out or should we have a fire department? Should we hack trails in the woods with machetes to one another's houses, or should we have roads, right? Well, economies are a perfect example of a complex collective action problem. And you can have an economy where some companies pay workers adequately so those workers can adequately consume, adequately take care of themselves and pay taxes, and a whole bunch of companies pay workers poverty wages, which essentially parasite off the rest of the economy. Or you can have an economy which requires every business to pay workers adequately. And if you take the latter course, you're going to have an economy that works better for everybody, including businesses.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at CEO pay, which these figures just astound me. You reference it skyrocketing from 30 times the median to 300 times the median over the last three decades. But we have a lot of CEOs. We have more than ever before. How did that happen, and how could we let that happen?
You know, I think it's a combination of things. But I think in my opinion, one of the dynamics that drove that behavior, that change, was essentially the a set of ideas that were that are adjacent to the first one you raised, which is if wages go up, employment will go down. So that idea is a core claim of trickle-down economics. Basically, the core claim of trickle-down economics is if the rich get richer, that's good for everybody. Right. A corollary of that is, of course, if the poor get richer, that will be bad for the economy. And in a country that on both the right and left accepted those principles, basically accepted the idea that the way to drive the economy was to cut taxes for rich people and make rich people richer, this behavior of underpaying workers and overpaying executives makes some kind of sense, right? Mm-hmm. It's a behavior that you can validate, you know, quote unquote, economically and morally as a consequence. But the truth is that it's a thriving middle class is the source of growth in a capitalist economy, not a concentration of wealth by a few rich people. And we basically got it backwards. And I think that until the country rotates essentially from trickle-down economics to what we call middle-out economics, the idea that a thriving middle class isn't the consequence of growth, it's the cause of growth in a capitalist society, you're going to have a lot more of that.
You make an interesting point. There are very few issues on which liberals, Democrats, or progressives and conservatives or Republicans can agree. You look at Walmart, the nation's largest employer, 1.4 million in this country, and yet many of them are getting Medicaid. Many of them are in poverty. They can't afford to shop at Walmart. They get food stamps. They get rent assistance, et cetera. If indeed we're going to embrace the idea of smaller government, why not pay Walmart workers a little more, and they may not need some of that federal assistance?
Precisely. It is unbelievable that America's largest company, a company that earns $27 billion in profit pre-tax per year, impoverishes its workers like this. And in most states, the largest group of welfare recipients are Walmart workers. The simple truth is that there is no law of the universe that says that Walmart needs to earn $27 billion a year in profit. Without raising prices a penny, they could take 10 of that $27 billion and give $10,000 a year raises to their 1 million lowest paid workers, and none of those people would need public assistance anymore, right? And all of those people would be much more successful consumers and participants, both in our economy and our democracy. And the simple truth is that Walmart doesn't pay those workers well because they are not required to do it. And until we require companies to pay workers adequately, we're going to have a system where taxpayers make up the difference. And by the way, it's not just Walmart, right? It's all these big retailers. The whole fast food industry is the same. They are essentially parasites on the real economy. And I can tell you, as a technology entrepreneur, where, you know, we have companies where at a minimum we pay people $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, it is super annoying to me that every single one of my employees can afford to buy the products that Starbucks makes, but none of the people who work at Starbucks in those stores can afford to buy the products that we make. And all of my people pay taxes, and most of those people require public assistance. And there is no earthly reason why Starbucks and McDonald's and Walmart and all these other huge companies can't pay those people enough for them be more robust participants in our economy.
Well, you must know some of those people. I don't, because I don't run in those circles, but you must know people who are very
wealthy. I do indeed.
What do they say? When you suggest that, what do they say?
Job killer! Job killer! They sputter. And that's because, look, the people who run these companies have had this crazy deal for a generation, right? They've had this unbelievable deal where, you know, people like me pay our workers well, and people like them pay their workers poverty wages, and then you taxpayers, you make up the difference, right? Well, who wouldn't want that deal? And they're going to hold on to that deal for as long as we let them hold on to it. But there is no earthly reason why these giant profitable companies cannot pay their workers enough so those workers can live and pay taxes and participate robustly in the economy and not need public assistance. And they're going to make up every excuse in the book about why they shouldn't be required to do that. They're going to talk about robots, and they're going to talk about this, and they're going to talk about that. It's all hogwash. It is simply preferring to keep wages low and profits high. That's it.
I was just imagining, as you suggested this, Walmart calling a press conference for later this evening and saying to the country, we are going to increase the wages of our workers $10,000. They will each be given $10,000 more a year. And I'm just wondering what would happen as a result of that. It's an interesting thing to just think about.
It is. It is. I mean, you think about the reverberating effects that would have in the economy. But here's the thing. I mean, I want to make one thing very clear. I am not trying to lead a moral – I'm not making principally a moral argument. I'm making a practical argument. I don't believe that you can shape a society successfully on the kindness of strangers. And I do not hold the managers and owners of Walmart to the standard that they should unilaterally decrease their profits and raise the wages of their workers by that much alone, because that will put them at a competitive disadvantage, and I don't think that that's reasonable to expect. What I think is unconscionable is that they are not at the forefront of a political movement to raise the minimum wage for every worker in the country so that every worker can afford to buy more stuff from Walmart, right? And that's what's super unconscionable, that they don't have the perspective and just the ability to think out more than past their next quarter's earnings to recognize that by solving this collective action problem, it will be good for the country and good for their company in the long term.
Our phone lines are jammed. We're going to start taking calls from the audience in just a moment. Nick Hanauer is our guest this hour. He is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. He's a technology entrepreneur. And interestingly, he has been speaking out all over the country on the minimum wage, a firm believer about a need for a $15 minimum wage. He has written a book. He's done a TED Talk, widely viewed, Beware Fellow Plutocrats, The Pitchforks Are Coming. We can no longer exist in the kind of country that we have with such widespread inequality without pretty severe ramifications. What do you think? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655, except that our lines are filled right now. So if you want to get a message in right away, send an email, talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls for Nick Hanauer, and we start with Douglas in Eau Claire. Hi, Douglas.
Hi, good afternoon. I just had a quick comment and a question. I can't believe that Scott Walker this spring, before he announced his candidacy, went out on the East Coast to raise money and approached the old guard from the Reagan administration to help him with crafting an economic policy around trickle-down economics. And I've enjoyed your videos online, and Nick, I just had a question. Have you found that economists and policymakers, which you had mentioned in some of your videos, as being very reluctant to come into the discussion about the real approach to economic activity, which is putting money in people's pockets? Have you found any new people that have signed on to your mission?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very complicated question. I think we're making progress. Obviously, the way in which the $15 minimum wage has spread across the country so quickly is a sign of that. And the and you know, we have worked very, very hard in the background to shape the national conversation about how economies work in a way that made that possible. The $15 minimum wage was basically that project was an effort to create a policy that essentially instantiated the idea of middle-out economics, that when workers have more money, businesses have more customers and need more workers. And traditional economists are coming around somewhat, but traditional economics is a completely, in my opinion, bankrupt misleading set of ideas rooted in some profoundly mistaken assumptions about how the world works and what people are like. And, you know, the simple truth is that we have mathematized economics in a way that makes it, you know, completely irrelevant to public discourse. And the truth is that economics, what real economics is how human societies decide who gets what and why. And these are political and moral questions. And trickle-down economics is simply a reflection of the idea by a few that, you know, we matter and y'all don't. And it's as old as human civilization. We used to call it divine right, and now you have trickle-down economics, and Scott Walker simply represents that view, that a few people in the society matter, most people don't, and policy should reflect that.
Do you ever feel uncomfortable about having so much money, Nick?
Oh, geez, that's an excellent and fair question. I mean, I'm a very big believer in capitalism, I don't want to take us off the subject, but I have a very different idea about what capitalism is and how we should structure it than sort of the contemporary or the sort of orthodox way of looking at it. So, I mean, I'm a big believer in capitalism's ability to both generate innovation, which is the source of increased living standards, and ennoble the human spirit by getting out of lots of people the most that they can contribute. So I don't feel bad about having tons of money, but what I do feel bad about is living in a society where so many people have so little.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I am often asked what motivates me, and you know, I want to live in a society where everybody feels like it's working for them. Because in that kind of society, it's just like, that's like going to a party. Living in a society where most people feel like they're getting screwed is like going to a funeral. And I prefer parties to funerals.
Yeah. So. Okay. Douglas, thanks for your call. Nate in Milwaukee. Hi.
Well, maybe our guests can give Nate a little money, because we're really short here in the north side of Milwaukee. I want to just say, with the pitchforks, we had that. In February of 2011, we had 150,000 people jam Madison night after night, day after day, with Jesse Jackson and Michael Moore. And we had them there. And then the state senators went to Illinois, and then they came back. And then Act 11 got passed, everybody went home.
Act 10, maybe there's an Act 11 now. There have been massive protests, but they fizzle out. So what makes you think, Nick, that what signs do you see that the pitchforks are coming?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm paraphrasing Scott Fitzgerald when I say, you know, revolutions come slowly and then suddenly, and the problem with these things is that you can't tell when the pitchforks are going to come. They just boom, they're there. And you know, the simple truth is that you know, things are getting harder for most people in the country, and if the current course and speed, they'll get harder and harder and harder as wages continue to be depressed and as costs go up. And at some point, you know, people stop protesting and they start burning stuff down. And that's when it gets super scary. And, of course, you know, you saw it in Ferguson and you see it, you saw it on the East Coast earlier in the summer and or early in the year. And you know, there are signs that things, people are starting to get really, really, really angry. And, you know, that and when people get that angry, you know, things can get very unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one would like to think that we could do the right thing before everything gets burned down.
Thank you, Nate, very much for your call. Jim in Rice Lake, hi.
I'm following up on the comments of the previous callers that and with this trickle-down economic situation is the result of decades-long lobbying by the American Enterprise Institute, ALEC, and other right-wing organizations to get where we're at. And with the recent Citizens United ruling, there doesn't seem to be any avenue for political reform that can offset these extremely powerful right-wing economic forces. And I personally believe, and I ask your guest this, won't it take 60s-level sustained social violence and unrest to get a response from the oligarchy that controls our society? Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
So the cynical side of me, wants to agree with that statement, but the more optimistic side of me wants to believe that there's a lot of ground that can be made up just by getting people to think differently about how the economy works. Let me just give you one great example, is that when you at the beginning of this interview, you said, you know, if wages go up, employment will go down. And the great challenge that we face is that when you say that, most people in this country nod in agreement.
Right.
And people on the right and left, if you say that to a United States senator, chances are they will nod in agreement, despite the fact that there is no evidence for it whatsoever. And what's been really, really striking about litigating these issues is how brainwashed the country has become around these issues. The idea that if we give tax breaks to rich people, that will somehow create growth. I mean, we all have to remember that we live in a democracy, and these policies were implemented by people that we elected collectively, who some of them were evil, but a lot of them thought they were doing the right thing because they just understood the economy in the wrong way. And I think that we are in the midst of a transformation in terms of our understanding of how economies work and what policies will make the society better. And I think that more and more people are coming around. The trickle-down crowd is getting more and more isolated. And I think, you know, if I'm optimistic, I want to believe that you know, you're gonna see some big changes. And I raise just two examples. Look, my friend David Rolfe and I were the ones who said we should raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and people laughed at us. They laughed at, and you can imagine how that first presentation went, right?
Yeah, I'm sure.
And yet here we are. You know, the last year we have spent pressuring the administration to massively increase massively increase the threshold below which people get paid overtime. Do you know about this thing? It's happening right now.
Yes.
So today, if you earn more than $23,600, you are not entitled to overtime automatically. In a matter of months, if you earn more than $51,000, less than $51,000, you will automatically be entitled to overtime. And the combination of these two things is going to make a big difference in people's lives. And those two big moves, raising the minimum wage to $15, why? Not because we feel sorry for people, but because it will drive more economic growth, these are big changes that can catalyze other things and point to a better future.
Mm. And you can almost see some of the angst being translated into this very bizarre presidential campaign, Nick. So you've got Bernie Sanders drawing these huge crowds, and then you've got Donald Trump, you know, who's so outside the establishment and may have some incredibly wacky ideas, but he's, you know, nobody's presidential candidate except himself, you know, because he can fund the whole thing. So it's pointing to this lack of faith that we have in the people who are supposed to be addressing these issues and huge crowds for somebody who's really taking on much of what you're talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that I just think that. So when we first, you know, if you turn the clock back just a few years, you know, this idea that if workers were paid more, it would be good for business. People looked at us like we were insane when we started talking about this. But, you know, by socializing these ideas, by talking about them, by doing TED Talks and all these things, all of a sudden this becomes like, oh, of course that's how the economy works. Of course that's what we should do. And, you know, I think that people's perspectives are changing, political leaders' perspectives are changing, and I think that you know we may make some really good progress on some of these issues over the next few years, but we have to push hard.
Dave in
and
Madison,
not let up.
Dave in Madison, hello.
Hello, I was wondering how many good billionaires does it take to overcome the works of one evil billionaire.
You know, the beautiful thing about him is you know, that we only represent 0.001% of the population. So, you know, you need zero good billionaires to get things done. You just got to get everybody else to kind of use common sense and elect the right people and make the right demands. I want to underscore that for 30 years, Democrats and Republicans, you know, people theoretically on the right and left thought that tax cuts for rich people were going to be good for the economy. And that's just not true. That's factually incorrect. It doesn't work. All it does is make rich people richer. Citizens need to push back on that nonsense and demand from legislators, both Democrat and Republican, to pass common sense economic policies. And, you know, look, you know, what's astounding is there's many poor Republicans as Democrats, and why you can't get the Republican House to be for an increase in the minimum wage is just it's staggering, right? And this is because Republican citizens aren't calling their legislators and saying, this is stupid. Why should you let McDonald's pay people this little amount and then I have to pay taxes to make up the difference? Mm-hmm. Nuts.
So what is, we've done a lot of shows on this, but I'm wondering, all those people who are in that upper 1% of the 1%, all those people who have incredible amounts of money, the idea was, well, they're going to help create businesses, they're going to invest in the economy, we're going to have more jobs. That hasn't happened. Where is all of that money going, Nick?
Well, a lot of it has happened. We have an incredibly dynamic economy and the world's most innovative economy. But the problem, and it takes capital, concentrated capital, to do that. The problem is we have essentially an infinite amount of capital and a paucity of demand, right? It's all about balance. So, we live in what, you know, a lot of economists now are calling the age of capital superabundance. When I was born, the S&P, the value of the S&P 500 to the American population in about 1959 was about $1,000 for every citizen. Today, it's $60,000 per citizen, right? So we've got capital all over the place. What we don't have is enough demand to incentivize and sustain that innovation. If the typical American family had the same share of income today that they had in 1980, they'd earn $25,000 or $30,000 more a year. Instead of $50,000, it'd be $75,000 or $80,000.
Hmm.
Well, if the typical family earned $25,000 more, yeah, people like me would probably have a bit less. But think about how many more cars and TV sets and haircuts and flowers on Mother's Day you'd sell, right?
Mm-hmm.
Think about how many more jobs the economy would require as a consequence of that demand. So it's all about balancing the need for concentrated capital and the need for incentives and the need for robust demand. And what we've done is we've let these things get wildly out of whack by concentrating too much power at the top.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking of the gentleman who just called us from the north side of Milwaukee, Nate, who talked about the fact that the help is needed, and help is needed. It's very high unemployment. The big industries that used to have good-paying jobs are gone now. And it's not just the north side of Milwaukee. It's a lot of central cities and places like Ferguson all over the country. So what is it that we can do and should do to make sure that all those people who would like to have jobs, because you have to have a job in order to have a life, what do we do about that? Do we create zones? Does the government do that? Does the people who have a whole lot of money have a responsibility to locate in those places that are suffering?
Well, again, you know, a really great place to start are economic policies that that balance the out who gets what out of enterprise, right? So here's a very important fact, that through the 50s and 60s, 70s, American corporations earned about 6% of GDP in profit. And wages were about, and these are averages, about 52% of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
Today, corporate profits are between 12 and 13% of GDP, and wages have fallen exactly by that amount to about 46% of GDP. So 6% of GDP is roughly $1 trillion. $1 trillion a year. So over 30 years, what's happened is $1 trillion in annual income has stopped flowing to people in the form of wages and instead is flowing into corporate treasuries as profits and then out to shareholders, right?
Yes, right.
And that $1 trillion, if it was spread out in the economy again, would create an enormous amount of demand that would create jobs for these people. Now, of course, you've got localized problems, right? There'll be an industry that goes out of business or whatever it is, and we have to find ways to help localities deal with these transitions. But the more generalized problem is that people buy a car once every 5 years and not once every 4 years or whatever it is. And I, by the way, I have no idea how often people buy cars. I just imagined that number. I just want to be clear. That's not a fact. But in an economy where the wages are more successfully balanced against profits, you have a more generalized and robust economy that will, you know, serve everybody's interest better.
More phone calls in a moment. Nick Hanauer is our guest this hour. Nick is in the upper 10th of 1%. He is a technology entrepreneur. And interestingly, he has been speaking out in many places, calling for a $15 an hour minimum wage. And he is looking at what has happened in terms of CEOs' pay and workers' pay, the inequality issue, and done so from, you know, this interesting position, because he's one of the very wealthiest guys in the country. And he's saying, wait a second, things aren't right here. Capitalism is good, but if it's not, if you don't look after it, watch out for the pitchforks. They're coming. What do you think? We welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls for Nick Rich in Rhinelander. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen and Gaz. Thanks. I'm all for this increase in wages program, but I'm at an age where I'm actually getting rid of stuff. I'm sitting on piles of stuff and looking at it and thinking about how I accumulated it. And I'm also greatly aware of people in certain parts of the society I inhabit don't have much stuff at all. So I would like to see government policies that sort of encourage or guide us to purchase things like solar panels or electric cars or other stuff. I don't know that I want to raise wages so the people at Walmart can buy more Walmart stuff. I'm a very bad example of that. I'm looking at my life in terms of it being fairly long, and I've done extremely well. But when I drive west out of the city of Milwaukee when I'm visiting on State Street or Island or any, I go through what is essentially a ghetto of poverty where people are concentrated in poverty. These are good people, and I want to see social policies that basically say not that wages are increased so we can just buy more stuff, that we have a direction in terms of what we want to see society become more integrated and more cohesive and coalescing about around everyone's benefit.
Nick.
Yeah, so I completely agree with that. And I don't mean to oversimplify, but I think that the quickest way to get people to coalesce around smart, cool, great stuff is to try to mitigate against poverty. So poverty, you know, poverty begets poverty. You know, I've never been poor myself, but I've been very close to it. And you know, we help some poor folks, and what you find is that, you know, people who are poor are trapped often by it. And you know, the thing about a $15 minimum wage, somebody going from earning $7.25 an hour to $15 an hour, is that it creates a context in which they can live, you know, a much more robust life, and honestly can make better choices for themselves, for them, for their families, and for their communities. And, I think that a huge problem we face in our country is that we pour money into programs to mitigate poverty and to mitigate against people's poor choices without ever having the courage to try to eliminate the poverty in the first place, right? Like, you know, a person earning $7.25 an hour, and who needs two jobs to hold, who needs to hold down two jobs to survive, isn't helping their children with homework. Right? Isn't volunteering in their community? Isn't watching out for neighbors? And you know, I think that everything gets better when everybody is better off.
Thank you, Rich, very much for your call, Mike in Franklin. Hi.
Yeah. Hi. Here's my take on this.
All right.
We have to stop listening to politicians like Scott Walker and Paul Ryan tell us that 7.25 is enough. It was good for them 20 years ago. It should be good for us. What we need to do is to elect brave politicians like Teddy Roosevelt was, like Franklin Roosevelt was, like Dwight Eisenhower was, that took on the special interests in their party and did what was great for all Americans, what was right for all Americans. We need to bring everybody up, and we can't let politicians talk down to us anymore. And then we have to support those politicians.
Yeah, I think you've called for a new deal, Nick.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I mean, so I co-authored a policy piece that's been making lots and lots of the rounds in the policy world called Shared Security, Shared Growth, that lays out essentially what we would do to try to fix all this stuff. You know, in the context of this very, very fast changing economy that we're in, and the idea of, you know, everybody becoming an Uber driver, which isn't very attractive to most people. And you know, if you're interested, Google Shared Security, Shared Growth.
Okay.
Which lays out essentially the New Deal that we're talking about.
Mary Jo asks this on Facebook. What do you think about the availability of credit perpetuating this cycle of keeping the economy running despite the difference of income between the classes?
I think I don't understand that question. What about credit?
Yeah, what do you think about the availability of credit, which keeps the economy running, and the availability of credit to people who maybe shouldn't have so much available credit, too, because you get in trouble with that, and then you're perpetuating poverty trying to pay back credit.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons that the country went into this severe recession is that we substituted credit for wages. If workers' wages had kept up with productivity, in other words, if workers had retained the same share of wages that they used to have, those workers wouldn't have had to borrow money and make themselves vulnerable to downturns. Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm all for credit. I think if you're not willing to deal with the wage issue, if you're not willing to confront the extra $1 trillion a year that American corporations are making that used to be wages, you can't get yourself out of this box. And just remember, this extra $1 trillion in profits isn't profits because it needs to be or should be or has to be. It's profits because powerful people like me prefer it to be. That $1 trillion could be used for wages, or it could be used for discounts for consumers. You know, this is all about power and preference, and those are the things that we need to attack, in my opinion.
Time for one more call. We have a minute left. Rick is next. Hello.
Yes, hello, Nick. I'd like to thank you for articulating this argument. I just have a fast comment, and as you pointed out, this is a public policy issue. However, whenever there are prescriptions or solutions put forth like what you have just put forth, it is deemed socialism, and the antithesis of what should be laissez-faire capitalism solving all our issues in conjunction with trickle-down economics. And until and unless that idea that any sort of public policy prescription is anathema, we're not going to succeed. So the key is get that message across.
Absolutely. And, you know, look, the people who want to have everything themselves and for you to have nothing will call every policy that seeks to change that socialism. But, you know, a minimum wage adequate to support a person in their life is no more socialism than a fire department is socialism. And I'm sure that when the first fire department was born, there was some clown who called it socialism. But, of course, they're wrong. It's idiotic to claim that. You can't run a society or an economy any other way.
Nick, thank you very much for being with us. It was really a good conversation. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Nick Hanauer, our guest this hour, and he recommended that you go to Shared Security, Shared Growth, just one of the things that he has written. He is in the upper one-tenth of 1%. He's a technology entrepreneur, and he is calling for a $15 minimum wage and really seriously addressing the wage inequality issue in this country, because this isn't the way that capitalism should work at its best. Thanks very much to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this hour. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll talk about Where Are All the Teachers? Hour 2.